This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. As part of our special holiday gift package, we have today the first of two mixes of voices from the last year. Voices we've heard and learned from, and voices that have shared insights and reflections and humor with us at times. Zachary, this has been fun, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. A theme that really comes through, too, is this theme of how important race is and how important identity is. And that's something that I think we've really been able to elucidate over the past few months.
I think that's right. You know, we often hear criticisms of identity politics and concerns about insensitivity to race and identity. So you can hear both sides of the argument there. I think in our programs, in our clips that we'll play on this mosaic of thoughts, we'll hear actually how sophisticated and creative many of our friends and colleagues are in bringing race into our democracy and bringing different identities into the way we think about democracy.
Yeah. Well, let's take a listen.
Let's take a listen.
Some of these earlier conceptions that I was raised with, an earlier generation, have faded away. And there's this very different individualistic and family and friends-centric worldview that now comprises the American dream.
Did this surprise you, Sam? Oh. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, so many people talk about monetary backgrounds, and it has nothing to do with that.
Hmm. And
or little. Let me rephrase. It has little to do with that. Money still matters.
Right.
But not nearly as much. And what's interesting is when you break it down, so I actually said, okay, well, let me run this and look at people who are wealthy versus a lot less wealthy and see if there's much of a difference here. The answer was no. They just didn't diverge, even though I expected that to possibly show up.
And what do you take as the implication of that?
Well, the implication is that when you ask people, are we living the American dream, are you on your way to achieve it, or is it just not possible, about 80 to 82% of Americans right now say they're either living the dream or are on the way to achieving it, quite optimistic. And again, it's remarkably consistent. You know, one story that we always hear about is that the coasts are booming and there are a few spots, in flyover country. And I hate using that word, but that's what so many people like to say. But in the heartland of America, these people are suffering. They're not realizing the American dream. When you break it apart, we're not seeing these differences at all. So what I take from this is that it would be good to share this narrative and remind America that despite the frustrations that people are having now, despite the negativity, despite the political class and the chatter of negativity and seeming culture war that we may have, it's not as bad. And we may want to remind ourselves that we're all still able to, most of us are able to live our lives the way we want. It's a value that almost all Americans seem to embrace. And, we could use a good kick in the pants to remind ourselves that things are not as bad.
I think the biggest thing, the contribution we can make to American democracy is bringing a culture of compassion and cooperation to our political system. Because today, if you look at the levels of polarization and the level of contempt we have for people of different views, it's toxic, and it's at some of the worst levels since
Absolutely.
The Civil War. And that is a fundamental threat to democracy. But our generation has grown up in this peer-to-peer environment. And we are a more inclusive generation, and that's true for every successive generation. And so we don't see issues of race and gender and sexual orientation in the same way, and we tend to be much more inclusive and welcoming of these different identities.
Yes.
And so if we can bring a level of compassion to our politics at a time when our country is becoming much more diverse, that will be potentially the biggest contribution as we seek this goal of being a multi-ethnic democracy, and I think we're headed in that direction. But it's really going to require millennials to create the kinds of communication, the kinds of understanding, the kinds of networks, and the political culture we need for that type of understanding and compassion to exist.
if we're ever going to get equality, we're going to have less racial privilege. And men, and Jeremy knows this too, because I know Jeremy is a feminist and so is Zachary as well. We're going to lose male privilege because it's not equal. We're going to lose male privilege. Sure. And we have to embrace that. So we don't run away from it and say, oh my gosh, why do women want equal pay? We say we love our daughters, our sisters, our mothers. And we can say we learn from them and are mentored by them, right? Right. That's what we say, right? But we're still men. We're still human beings, but we don't have to dominate anybody to be who we are. So part of this is a politics of racial privilege, but part of it is really that morally, we've lost sight of why racial integration matters.
No system is free of human frailties. How do we learn to address these issues? How can we be honest about the limitations of our systems? We have to be realistic and skeptical, as well as ideological. And then third, I think one of the real lessons from Siena and Florence is that good government requires good institutions and good people in those institutions. And finding good people to be representative of us, electing good people, supporting good people. There's no substitute for integrity. Intelligence is important, but there's no substitute for integrity. Most of us choose our life partners because we choose them for integrity. We should choose our representatives based on integrity as well. That's a lesson from the Renaissance.
Well, most workplaces are not democracies, right? I mean, it is ironic in this country where we like to think that we can help shape our own environment, that workplaces are often tyrannical places.
Yes.
You're told where to be, at what time, how long to do this, in some cases, whether you can take a bathroom break or not, how much time you have for lunch. These are very difficult work sites. People spend a great deal of their working hours in these workplaces, and yet they have very little say over their own lives and, you know, what is a good way to handle this job, what is a bad way. You know, most employers say, do it, or we'll find someone else to do it. So I just think the workplace is a kind of ironic place if we talk about democracy.
Sure. One case is that I've never been elected to the executive committee of my department. Again, it might be at the beginning I thought it was because I'm not sympathetic enough. I mean, that is fine. But then if you begin to see these patterns, wider patterns, it so happens that it's widespread. It's not only me, but it's widespread. So most Hispanics on campus are outside networks of authority and hierarchies of authority. There is only two deans in the entire university who are Hispanics, and these are deans of very poor colleges, education and social work, with very little clout in general. Then there is one example. I just want to put you on one example, which is striking because it's the case of LILAS. LILAS is the Latin American studies center, of one of the greatest on earth, literally.
Yeah.
Dating back to, this is a surprise to me, I didn't know. I thought it was the product of the Cold War. It is not.
Right. Precedes it.
Precedes. Founded in 1943 or something.
I think so, yeah.
And it has a history of about 80 years or more, 79 years or so. It has had 13 directors, none of them Latinos or Hispanic.
The rhetoric was full pay for your low-income students.
Okay.
So that's embedded, right, in us. We need the full pays. But now it still is this this white savior complex, almost.
Okay.
And I have a huge problem with that because I feel like it takes dignity away from the community by saying that one community is paying for the other.
Right.
So in addition, there's also this we say, oh, when we are recruiting multicultural students, low-income students, or first-generation students, you know, it's diversity. We coin them, it's adding diversity. It's, if we do this, it's adding value. So there's a return on the investment for the community that already exists here. Mm-hmm. It's never a rhetoric of the other way around. We only tell the story one way.
Yes.
In my opinion, it should be, we're doing this because this community deserves it.
Right.
And we have a civic duty to do so.
Right.
And that should be the value add, not that, hey, and it happens in corporate America as well.
Sure.
When you think about it, they talk about, oh, let's do diversity and recruitment, chief diversity officers, so that, and it proves that we'll get higher revenues, higher profits.
Right.
Instead of, no, people just deserve these positions because they're equally as good, if not better.
Working first as a journalist, then, you know, as an activist, then on a political campaign where I learned a lot of things about what not to do, you know, in the Senate office, in the executive branch, as a diplomat, I think what you learn is how to build coalitions inside government and with other countries, you know, how to speak to individuals from the vantage point of their equities and their interests. And so is much more about taking the same old vector from that I probably have had or been on from the very beginning, but operationalizing it, you know, in complicated institutions. I mean, how to work with Congress, especially in an era of polarization. You know, what is the right way to establish a partnership with the chairman of the joint staff on peacekeeping, for example? Like, I might have always thought that peacekeeping should be improved, but to figure out how to make that argument effectively with the Pentagon, that was a different language for me.
Hong Kong people have never been able to vote for their top leader, and not when it was the British colony, not since the handover. And so this is really something that Hong Kong people want. They want a leader that they vote for, that can be held accountable. And because right now a big issue too with Carrie Lam is she has said she's not stepping down, she's not resigning, and she's going to continue with her role, but she's not popular among Hong Kong people, and because Hong Kong people feel that she has made mistakes and she is not bearing the responsibility. So that's another issue that the protesters want the government to address.
Well, we should say from the outset that clearly not all North Koreans believe this, you know, because if they all believe this, there would be no defectors.
Right.
And people do defect every year. But it's astonishingly small number. I just checked the numbers last week, and I want to say it was less than 30,000 over the last 10 years.
Wow.
That is not a large number of
defectors.
And many of these defectors actually end up going back to North Korea.
Hmm.
And this is very, very hard for us to understand. But the reason that they do is because in North Korea, life is about something. And many of these people come to the South, and they try to integrate into, you know, a liberal capitalist society, and the South Korean government does what they can to help them. But the truth is they find life there very alienating, and they find life in China very alienating, because as twisted as the narrative is that the regime tells them, it actually gives purpose to their struggle. And it really gives meaning to their life. You know, their life is a daily struggle for survival for the Korean race. And this is something that gives them meaning and gives them purpose. And they have a hard time really reorientating their life in another way.
Right.
And it's important to note, too, that this is what they're taught. And certainly, even if they don't believe it, it's hard for them to know what to believe because there's no counter-narrative to this information in North Korea, no consistent counter-narrative coming in.
When we were sitting and waiting in the waiting room, the hall, there's like a big hall, maybe 60, 70 people waiting, and you're watching people go in and out.
Yes.
And you see some people come out and they got big smiles on their face, and you know things went well. But once in a while, you have, you know, somebody walk through that door and you can see they're on the verge of breaking down. That made the process real for me. And that made me realize that, you know, we often talk about immigration in this country. We talk about policies, politics, ideology. We talk about all kinds of things. It's easy to forget that there are real people who are going through this process.
Yes.
And I can't judge whether, you know, some of those folks had their naturalization process denied for right or wrong reasons. I can't comment on that. What I can say is, though, that you could see on their face that this was a life-shattering, you know, event.
Of course, of course.
And that really brought it home.
Well, and for many of them, this is not just a dream. This is a source of salvation, right?
Yes, might be a question of survival, absolutely.
Yeah, so in our experience running these focus groups with Ukrainian students, I think cynicism is one of the big overarching themes that we've seen. And I don't think it's tied to any kind of regional variation. We've spoken to students in the east, in cities like Kharkiv, or in the west, like cities like Lviv and Ivano-Frankivsk. And I think overall, there's this general kind of cynicism that all the candidates that are running are corrupt and that their vote doesn't matter. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case with the young generation, which we in the West hope to be the generation that really brings Ukraine.